Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani, all rights reserved. Chapter 6. Gwendolyn meowed a polite greeting from the side porch where she sat beside a reserved black cat with trim white socks, whom Callie immediately dubbed Sanford, after the original Gwendolyn's kindly but reserved husband. She now had so many cats, it didn't even cross her mind that the new one wouldn't stick around. She knew he would. During the following weeks, a pattern developed somewhat as planned. Callie worked from 8 to noon at the granary, then met Billy at the house, where the two of them worked together until about 5. The only fly in the ointment took the form of Joe McDermott, who stopped at the granary every morning to gossip with Penn. The first morning she worked there, he placed a box of dog biscuits on the counter in front of her. "I didn't know you had a dog," she remarked conversationally. "I don't," he replied. "These are for Nana." Callie examined the biscuits' ingredients and shook her head. "No," she told him, replacing that box with one of specially formulated gourmet treats for older dogs. "These are better for her." He looked at the price on the box and his eyes widened slightly in surprise. Nonetheless, he replaced the dollar and loose change he had originally put on the counter with a 5. When she rang up the sale, he asked, "Would you mind explaining something for me?" "What?" "According to Penn, you're somewhat of a legend as well as an enigma around here." Evidently, some of what passed through Callie's mind showed on her face when he said that, because he added, "I was an English major before I switched to forestry." Callie personally found the idea of being a legendary enigma appealing, but she had the uneasy feeling that this might not mean the same thing to the Addison residents as it did to her. "So what else does the legend say about me?" she inquired, somewhat tentatively. "That even though you get along with just about everyone, you're a loner, and always have been." The first time Callie invited a friend from nursery school home to play, Bernice pulled out all the maternal stops and served them her cold paste on stale crackers, some shriveled green beans Mrs. Murray had dropped off weeks previously, and water in paper cups. The second time, Howard was off hunting, and Venus served chopped iris petals and Miracle Whip on stale crackers with jelly glasses filled with peach brandy. Fortunately, Billy was a friend both times. Callie never invited anyone home after that, and never felt comfortable going anywhere but to Billy's because she knew she couldn't reciprocate. Had Billy not thought it all very funny and taught her to see the humor in even her parents' most absurd behaviors, she would have run away from home years before she finally escaped to college. "Yes, I think that part of the legend's pretty true," she told Joe. The next day, Joe laid a bag of run-of-the-mill dog food on the counter. "For Nana?" she inquired. He nodded. She shook her head and pointed to a display of premium kibble for older canines. He returned the first bag and picked up the second. When she rang up the sale, he replaced a 20 he had taken out of his wallet and extracted a credit card. "The legend also says you don't like people who beat around the bush," he volunteered casually.
"Says who?"
"Penn again," he admitted. "He said you could probably deal with anything if people were up front about it, but if they put you through a lot of ritual first, you'd..." "Cut their balls off?" she laughed, recalling her encounter with Gideon Carter, but then she noticed Joe's puzzled expression. "No, Penn probably wouldn't say that, but that would be the gist of it, I think." Callie had already gotten the feeling that Joe's interest in Nana's diet and his small talk comprised some sort of ritual, and it bothered her. Bernice waited until 3 days after Callie's first menstrual cycle began to tell her what was happening, because she wanted to do it just right. For 3 days, Callie clutched her aching abdomen and cried herself to sleep, convinced she was bleeding to death and no one cared. When Venus wanted to tell Callie something and couldn't quite get it out, she donned her 7 veils, 7 old curtains actually, and danced through the house for hours until she finally worked up the nerve to do so. During that time, Callie's vivid imagination led her to envision the worst. Venus suffering from some terminal disease or the family out on the streets because Howard had lost his job. Invariably, though, the great revelation consisted of nothing more than Venus announcing that she had decided to use a magic rock instead of deodorant. When George invited her to visit him to see the animals, she knew he didn't mean that either. The first of a succession of men who said they wanted one thing when they really wanted another. Even dear sweet David would beat around the bush about countless, mostly inconsequential topics, as if she were too fragile or stupid to handle the truth. Because of all that, she had admired Joe McDermott's directness following her parents' death. Now she wondered whether that admiration had been misplaced. The third day, Joe arrived before her practically engulfed by the largest dog bed Penn sold, a huge puffy nest that contoured itself around its lucky canine owner. Very chic and very pricey. "I figured I might as well pick the most expensive one to begin with and save us both a lot of time," he remarked semi-sarcastically. "Unless you plan on sleeping with Nana, I don't think she needs such a large bed," Callie informed him. "Plus, given her age and weight, one of the flatter orthopedic beds would be a lot easier for her to get in and out of." He muttered something under his breath and exchanged the bed for a more appropriate one. "Joe, do you recall my legend? The one about my being a loner who hates people who beat around the bush and engage in meaningless ritual?" she asked as he handed her his credit card yet again. When he nodded, she demanded, "What do you want?" He looked momentarily startled, then, finally, donned the forthright expression she had noticed and appreciated following her parents' deaths. "I want to know when you're going to fuck me," he demanded back. Not that long ago, Callie would have considered such a crude proposal beneath contempt and not worthy of a response, no matter how forthright. But in the murky realm of deception and indecision in which she currently dwelled, she found its clarity of purpose refreshing. "At last, an honest man." But when, exactly, would she have sex with such a man? "How about when hell freezes over?" she suggested. "That's sooner than I thought," he remarked as he picked up his dog bed and left. Once in the parking lot, Joe cursed himself for letting her get to him like that. Sure, he wanted to fuck her. What guy with two eyes and half a brain wouldn't? But he didn't tell her that to be truthful. He told her that to shock her, to punish her for pushing his buttons, to punish her for making him care. For the first month, Billy and Callie concentrated on converting the two connecting rooms between the house and barn into a cat room and a small treatment room. Thanks to her parents' meticulous preparations prior to offing themselves, Callie had no lifetime of accumulated junk to clean out. However, the rooms hadn't been used in years, and she and Billy spent hours patching, sanding, painting, and refinishing the walls and floors. Making the foundation sound particularly concerned her because the cellar didn't extend into this area, and several small openings allowed rodents as well as drafts to enter. Although she knew the cats would dispense any rodents, the drafts would create problems come winter. So while Billy sanded and finished the floors and got the propane space heater up and running, she sealed any opening she found in the exterior walls and foundation. Once they made the area structurally sound, Billy built shelves and benches for the cats to sleep on and storage bins for food and litter. During that same period, Callie made and hung climbing ropes, catwalks, and mobiles for feline entertainment. While Billy built cupboards and a counter in the smaller treatment room, she washed years of grime off the windows, measured the odd-sized windows for insulated drapes, and put up drapery rods. During one of their breaks, Billy noticed Bernice's spatula and wire whisk on the kitchen counter where Callie had tossed them, still in their plastic bag. He removed them and pretended to mix something in a bowl. "Happy brownies. Very good," he signed. "You bake?" she signed. "Sometimes." "You want those?" He nodded. "Yes." "They're yours." Callie handed them to him, glad to get the troublesome utensils out of the house. His face lit up with joy, and she changed the subject. "I don't want anyone to know I have all these cats." She could read the why on his face as plain as day. "I don't want people to think I'm as strange as my parents," she further explained. He nodded gravely. "Yes, I can understand that." Then he made their sign for small, touched his head, and raised his eyebrows. "They were a little off, weren't they?" She laughed and nodded. "Yes, they were. But they were good people," he added, waving the spatula. Callie didn't know what to say to that. She wanted to agree, but the image of him finding her parents dead in those garish outfits loomed so large in her mind, it left no room for such positive thoughts about them. A few weeks later, when the custom-made drapes and matching pillows arrived, Callie hung the drapes and arranged the pillows on the shelves while Billy filled the litter boxes under the benches. Next, they put away the additional supplies and equipment she had ordered to cover any problem that might befall the cats or Nana. Why not buy cat food from Penn? Billy signed as he picked up one of the cases of canned food the delivery man had left on the porch. Too much food, too many cats, she replied. She felt guilty purchasing the same items that Penn carried from a Massachusetts supplier, but she didn't see how she could buy these locally without raising suspicion. While she might convince others she fed more than a dozen feral cats, knowing that she supplied them with toys and pillows would surely give her legend a nudge in a direction she didn't want it to go. Billy observed her attentively as she converted these thoughts to looks and hand signals, then thankfully signed, "I understand." After they put all the food away and added a few finishing touches to the room, they admired their work. She smiled at Billy and raised her thumbs. "We did a good job." He smiled back and nodded, "Yes, we did." Although Billy totally agreed with Callie, the cat scrutinized every corner of their new quarters warily. This surprised Callie because until then she'd kept all but Gwendolyn and Sanford in their carriers and thought their new freedom would delight them. "Why not let them run loose?" Billy had initially signed when he saw all those cats in all those carriers. She gave him the usual party line about the cats getting lost or hurt. "You didn't mind cats outdoors when you lived here before," he reminded her. She could have told him that she changed her mind since she became a veterinarian, but that wasn't true. Instead, she signed the truth. "I just can't bear to lose anyone else right now." He nodded and patted her hand. Callie also kept the cats in their carriers while she and Billy constructed the cat room because she didn't want them to get used to having free run of the main house. Once accustomed to all that space, their confinement to a single room would surely bother them, and that could lead to problems. Rather than risk that, she only let them out at night to sleep with her, and then she kept the bedroom door closed to prevent roaming. Feeding them in their carriers guaranteed that they'd make a beeline for these every morning. But now, after all those careful plans and all her and Billy's hard work, Callie couldn't help feeling depressed when the cats didn't share her enthusiasm for their new space. Billy touched her arm, then gave a familiar signal. "Call Nana." Callie did as directed, though she had no idea what he had in mind. When she did, Nana heaved her old body from the spot under the blue spruce in the backyard where she planted herself every day and waddled in. Billy looked at her solemnly, and she looked at all those cats, some of whom were not at all pleased to see her. She looked back at Billy, and he tugged gently on her ears. She sighed and lumbered over to one of the kittens and started grooming it. Then she licked another and another. After the third kitten, Nana really got into it, and soon all the cats clustered around her like a bunch of sharks waiting for a cleaner fish to remove parasites, old scales, and body slime. Callie had no idea why Nana's ministrations worked, but in no time the cats acted like they'd lived in that room forever. "Nana is good with cats," Billy signed with a broad grin when Nana finished giving George a good scrubbing. "No kidding," Callie replied, laughing. Billy and Nana left, and the cats appeared so content that, by the time bedtime rolled around and Callie let Gwendolyn and Sanford out for the night at their request, she decided to sleep alone. She did enjoy sleeping with the cats and had even purchased a king-size bed to accommodate them. At the same time, though, she remained determined to pull herself together in body, mind, and spirit, as Alicia always instructed her. And a newly initiated phase of her self-improvement program conflicted with her feline sleeping habits. Shortly after returning to New Hampshire, Callie read an article in a natural health magazine describing all the perils awaiting women her age who didn't drink enough water, including wrinkles and weak kidneys. Although her kidneys felt fine, she had noticed some previously overlooked wrinkles around her eyes while sitting in that Utah sink suturing her face. Under other circumstances, the status of neither her kidneys nor her wrinkles would have interested her. However, because her attempts to pull herself together mentally seemed to succumb to one setback after another, she decided to focus on upgrading her physical self instead. A basic knowledge of physiology told her that, if she began drinking 8 glasses of water a day to head off wrinkles, she might need to get up more in the middle of the night. However, nothing in any of her physiology courses discussed the ramifications of nocturnal micturition relative to the disruption of a dozen sleeping cats, some of whom responded less charitably than others. Nor did her education delve into the perils of trying to get back into bed before said cats had time to commandeer her space. When this occurred, as it inevitably did, every trip to the bathroom cost her at least a half hour's sleep by the time everyone got settled again. Hence, one of the driving forces behind finishing the cat room took the form of her plan to keep the cats in the cat room 1 week, during which she drank much water for wrinkle control and kidney health. Then she'd sleep with the cats the following week, during which she'd hardly drink anything at all, but would feel loved. That the cats had settled nicely into the cat room that very first day, and she reclined in her bed with her laptop and a glass of water, reading an email from David, seemed to bode well for her new plan. David's first few electronic epistles had contained numerous troubling references to how much he loved and missed Callie, interspersed with equally troublesome questions about her new equine practice. Over time, though, he began writing more and more about her replacement, Marilyn, a shift in attention Callie heartily endorsed. This Sunday, Marilyn and I went to a potluck supper sponsored by the Methodist Church to raise money for the Sunday school soccer team. Marilyn brought a layered jello salad in the team colors, decorated with a soccer ball made out of mini marshmallows and licorice gum drops. Everyone went crazy when they saw it, he wrote, describing such a typically sweet Sunday afternoon with David activity that Callie could feel her blood sugar rising. If you and Marilyn aren't a match made in heaven, I don't know who is, she wrote him sincerely after she drank more water and went to the bathroom. At about 3 a.m. that morning, Callie was sitting on the john half asleep when she heard a cat meow below her. Not knowing where else to look, she looked in the toilet bowl. Nothing. Oh, God, it started, she shuddered involuntarily. I'm getting as crazy as my parents. Meow, meow, went the toilet again. In spite of herself, Callie got down on her knees next to the toilet and chirped encouragingly. Here, kitty, 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 kitty. Meow, meow. Pitiful meowing convinced her that somehow a cat had gotten trapped under her toilet because the alternative, madness, struck her as unacceptable. Grabbing the puckered edge of the ancient linoleum behind the tank, she yanked as hard as she could. When she did, a big chunk of the brittle flooring broke off to reveal the original pine planks beneath. Over the years, either condensation from the tank or a slow leak had sufficiently rotted the wood that she was able to cautiously pry up enough of it in 3 hours to expose two scruffy cats. When she saw them, she immediately thought of that burst of clairvoyance that had led her to name Justine the cat before she gave birth to 6 offspring, just like her namesake. Rather than indicators of her meager self-esteem, could all of those years of toilet dreams have been subconsciously preparing her to save these poor creatures' lives? By the time Callie ascertained the cat's ages, about 8 months, sexes, 1 male, 1 female, health, not bad for living under a toilet, temperament, pretty good for living under a toilet, and possible parentage, most likely Gwendolyn and Sanford since they looked just like them, the early morning sun streamed through the bathroom window. It also streamed through the hole in the foundation below the toilet through which the cats had obviously entered and exited at their leisure. After Callie returned home from her morning stint at the granary and explained to Billy why she'd torn up the bathroom floor and why they needed to check the floors and foundations of the main house for any holes, too, she called Alicia. She wanted to know if the therapist considered finding cats under the toilet a breakthrough event that might single the end of her toilet dreams. She also wanted to know if Alicia could recommend a therapist in the Addison area. Instead of her therapist, however, she got a recorded message informing her that Alicia had gone to a conference in Acapulco. Lacking her therapist's professional assistance, Kelly named a new female cat Alicia and decided to go therapist list for a while. She barely had time to name the male Rex after Alicia's husband before he disappeared through the hole in the foundation. Callie considered this appropriate behavior because Alicia's husband also had a way of disappearing, possibly because of Alicia's fanatic attempts to get pregnant. This came out in Callie's third therapy session when Alicia asked how Callie felt about children. It seemed an odd question for a therapist to ask a patient bemoaning her inability to experience a meaningful relationship with a man. Nonetheless, Callie told Alicia she thought babies were all right. Alicia burst into tears.
I love them too, she sobbed, and I can't have them because Rex has a low sperm count.
Callie said, that's too bad, rather than, Why are you telling me this? Because she had yet to tell Alicia about her real fear, which was that she could become as crazy as her family, and didn't want to alienate her. Evidently, Alicia thought, "That's too bad," meant, "Tell me all about it," because she did. This gave Callie her first inkling that she had chosen a therapist whose operating system might have a few glitches, but then she decided this might not be such a bad thing. After all, if she listened patiently to Alicia's rambling discourse about how Rex's briefs were cooking his sperm, surely the therapist would let her ramble about her relationship with George and his gerbil. It sounded good in theory, but 7 years later, Callie had to admit that she'd learned a lot more about Rex's sperm than about herself during all those years of therapy. You've been listening to an excerpt from Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani. For more information about this and other books by the author, please visit mmilani.com. The song Irritations into Pearls was composed and performed by Jeff Firestone. For more information about Jeff and his music, please contact him at retromusic@verizon.net. Thanks for listening.